For Claude. Summon your witnesses. Aeschylus. Part 1. Fleischmann is in trouble. Toby Fleischmann awoke one morning inside the city he lived in all his adult life, and which was suddenly somehow now crawling with women who wanted him. Not just any women, but women who were self-actualized and independent and knew what they wanted. Women who weren't needy or insecure or self-doubting, like the long-ago prospects of his long-gone youth, meaning the women he had thought of as prospects but who had never given him even a first glance. No, these were women who were motivated and available and interesting and interested and exciting and excited. These were women who would not so much wait for you to call them one or two or three socially acceptable days after you met them, as much as send you pictures of their genitals the day before. Women who were open-minded and up for anything, and vocal about their desires and needs, and who used phrases like, put my cards on the table, and no strings attached, and I need to be done in 10 because I have to pick up Bella from ballet. Women who would fuck you like they owed you money, was how our friend Seth put it. Yes, who could have predicted that Toby Fleischmann, at the age of 41, would find that his phone was aglow from sunup to sundown, in the night the glow was extra bright, with texts that contained G-string and ass cleavage and underboob and side boob and just straight up boob, and all the parts of a woman he never dared dream he would encounter in a person who was three-dimensional, meaning literally three-dimensional, as in a person who wasn't on a page or a computer screen. All this after a youth full of romantic rejection. All this after putting a lifetime bet on one woman. Who could have predicted this? Who could have predicted that there was such life in him yet? Still, he told me, it was jarring. Rachel was gone now, and her goneness was so incongruous to what had been his plan. It wasn't that he still wanted her. He absolutely did not want her. He absolutely did not wish she were still with him. It was that he had spent so long waiting out the fumes of the marriage and busying himself with the paperwork necessary to extricate himself from it, telling the kids, moving out, telling his colleagues, that he had not considered what life might be like on the other side of it. He understood divorce in a macro way, of course, but he had not yet adjusted to it in a micro way, in the other side of the bed being empty way, in the nobody to tell you we're running late way, in the you belong to no one way. How long was it before he could look at the pictures of women on his phone? Pictures the women had sent him eagerly and of their own volition, straight on, instead of out of the corner of his eye. Okay, sooner than he thought, but not immediately. Certainly not immediately. He hadn't looked at another woman once during his marriage. So in love with Rachel was he. So in love was he with any kind of institution or system. He made solemn, dutiful work of trying to save the relationship, even after it would have been clear to any reasonable person that their misery was not a phase. There was nobility in the work, he believed. There was nobility in the suffering. And even after he realized that it was over, he still had to spend years, plural, trying to convince her that this wasn't right, that they were too unhappy, that they were still young and could have good lives without each other. Even then, he didn't let one millimeter of his eye wander. Mostly, he said, because he was too busy being sad. Mostly because he felt like garbage all the time. And a person shouldn't feel like garbage all the time. More than that, a person shouldn't be made horny when he felt like garbage. The intersection of horniness and low self-esteem seemed reserved squarely for porn consumption. But now, there was no one to be faithful to. Rachel wasn't there. She was not in his bed. She was not in the bathroom, applying liquid eyeliner to the area where her eyelid met her eyelash.